Hi, I'm David Fettes, and welcome to this talk on collective behavior in our study of sociology. The term collective behavior refers to social processes and events which do not reflect existing social structures, laws and conventions and institutions, but which emerge in a spontaneous way. So when our textbook talks about this, it's saying things just kind of happen. They're not just going with the usual structured way of doing things. Collective behavior might also be defined as action which is neither conforming, in which actors follow prevailing norms, nor deviant, in which actors violate those norms. Collective behavior, a third form of action, takes place when norms are absent or unclear or seem to contradict each other. So it's not a deliberate rebellion against the standards, but it's not exactly following the standards either. It's kind of a fluid situation where the standards either aren't there or aren't very clear or are kind of messy. Examples of collective behavior include religious revival meetings. A revival meeting may be different than the usual church service because people start doing things that are more unusual and they start doing them together. Or there may be a panic in a burning theater. There again, people are suddenly doing things out of the norm. A sudden widespread interest in a website or a clothing item. A collective social movement to improve the environment. Or the rapid spread of rumors. So there's lots of collective behavior, a lot of variety. And these diverse actions fall within the area sociologists call collective behavior. And the Bible has some examples of collective behavior as defined by the sociologists as well. Here's an example of nasty collective behavior. You've got a mob together. With one voice they cried out, "Away with this man! Release Barabbas to us!" Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again, but they kept shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" With loud shouts, they insistently demanded that Jesus be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So here was a collective group of people who were yelling for Jesus to be killed, and they got their way. Here's another example of collective behavior that involved some of the very same people, probably. Peter on Pentecost is preaching to a group of people in Jerusalem 7 weeks after Jesus was crucified, and he says, "God has made this Jesus whom you crucified both Lord and Christ." When the people heard this, they were cut to the heart. Those who accepted his message were baptized, and about 3,000 were added to their number that day. So you had collective behavior of a lot of people wanting to kill Jesus, but then a whole bunch of people at the same time repenting and wanting to belong to Jesus. Later on in the book of Acts, we read about Paul and Barnabas in the city of Lystra, and they heal a person miraculously. When the crowd saw what Paul had done, they shouted in the Lyconian language, "The gods have come down to us in human form." Shortly thereafter, others won the crowd over. They stoned Paul and dragged him outside the city, thinking he was dead. So, collective behavior is sometimes pretty fickle. One moment you're a god, the next minute they want to kill you. So, sometimes collective behavior can be great in a true religious revival where a lot of people are swept up in faith. Sometimes it can be just wrong, you know. Paul and Barnabas weren't gods, but everybody thought they were. So collective behavior can be all over the map on whether it's good or bad and in the kinds of people that it involves. There's a difference, as sociologists use the terms, between collective behavior and group behavior. Collective behavior usually is a limited, short-lived social interaction, whereas group behavior involves a group that has a longer-term existence and the group remains together. In the collective behavior, there's no clear social boundaries. There's just a bunch of people together, and maybe they don't even know each other well enough to segment who belongs where or to set whose duties are what. In a group where you've been together, who you let into the group is more discriminating. What the roles are more understood. Again, with collective behavior, there's weak and less conventional norms. In a group, there's stronger and clearer expectations, more conventional norms. So a group is something that exists together for a longer period of time and has its standards and so on. Collective is often more of a shorter-term phenomenon that happens, which doesn't involve longer-term relationships as much. Collective behavior in sociology includes four forms: the crowd, the public, the mass, and the social movement. While there's a degree of debate over what should be included under the label of collective behavior among sociologists today, often included are additional behaviors like rumors, riots, trends, and fads. Why would you study collective behavior? Well, here's one example that the textbook gives. In 1979, 11 fans were killed and many others injured in the rush for seating at the opening of a sold-out rock concert by The Who. Now, if they had understood collective behavior a little better, then there might have been better architectural design and methods of crowd management to avoid this kind of tragedy. How to redesign buildings and manage crowds are two types of knowledge that can result from the study of collective behavior. Understanding how people behave in riots, what sets them off, and how they can be rapidly concluded, how to bring an end to a riot, is also knowledge that can result from the study of collective behavior. Additionally, understanding how humans react during natural disasters and ensure that the damage that occurs is a result of the disaster and not the human response to it. Disasters happen, but if governments or communities are more prepared, then when a disaster happens, instead of having just a terrible panic and all kinds of wild behavior, if you understand a bit about collective behavior and how to manage it, you can have, okay, there's still going to be injuries and maybe even deaths from the disaster itself, but you don't want to be the human response to it to be worse than the bad stuff that happened. Another motivation for studying collective behavior is in order to actually change elements of society. This is the component of collective behavior known as social movements. For instance, in the 1965 March on Selma, peaceful demonstrators for racial equality were viciously attacked by the police. National TV showed these attacks, and that provoked a national response, which led to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Within months of its passage, 250,000 new black voters had been registered. Within 4 years, voter registration in the South had more than doubled, and much of this was triggered by that March on Selma, by that action, and it was even kind of an atrocity that it happened. But sometimes public demonstrations can serve as the trigger for a movement that has longer-term impact. Understanding how to organize a social movement to pursue social change is one of the areas studied by sociologists. Better understanding how to organize such a movement can provide movement members the tools they need to succeed. So if you're part of a movement or you want to create a movement, sometimes sociological study can help you figure out what's the role of a demonstration, what's the role of group behaviors, how do we get a social movement going. Sometimes, of course, it's not that clinical, things just happen and people get excited or they get outraged and a movement takes off on its own. But very often organizers understand more than a little bit about how to trigger a popular uprising or a demonstration, and which can in turn lead to a movement. A crowd is a gathering of people who share a purpose or intent and influence one another. Crowds are a common occurrence in modern life. Most sporting events, concerts, and other performances result in the gathering of crowds. And there's different kinds of crowds. There may be a casual crowd, which is just a bunch of people that happen to be in the same place at the same time. A loose collection of people with no real interaction. For example, you go to the mall, there's hundreds of people at the mall, but you don't know hardly any of them, and you're just there at the same time. Then there's conventional crowds, which refers to planned meetings, like a community meeting led by politicians. You're all there, you're gathered there for a purpose and according to a plan. There are expressive crowds, for instance, at political rallies or soccer games or some other sporting event. They get emotionally charged. They may be screaming at the referees or cheering joyfully for their team. An expression of worship where people are expressing their emotions, and it's a very emotionally charged event, an expressive crowd. And then there's an acting crowd, a crowd that wants to get something done. For instance, a crowd rushing the stage at a concert. They want to be up there with the person they idolize, but they want to do something. Or there may be crowds that are intent on toppling statues of a leader who is reviled, and no longer do they want him in power, but the crowd is acting and they want to do something. When crowd behavior is directed toward a specific violent end, the result is a mob. Mobs tend to be highly emotional. That's putting it nicely. Violent crowd behavior without a specific goal is a riot. Because riots do not have a specific end, it is assumed that their intention is to express general dissatisfaction. Of course, sometimes once riots get going, you have looters who just want to grab stuff for themselves, and they're not really dissatisfied. They just want stuff. But sometimes a widespread riot means there was widespread dissatisfaction. An example of a mob appears in the Bible in Acts chapter 7. Stephen has been preaching to people who accuse him of speaking against Moses and against the temple and against God, and he goes on to explain the history of Israel and how Jesus fulfills the promises, and then he says, "You stiff-necked people, you always resist the Holy Spirit." And when they heard this, they were furious and gnashed their teeth at him. And then Stephen said, "I see heaven opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." And that made them even angrier. And yelling at the top of their voices, they all rushed at him, dragged him out of the city, and began to stone him. And they killed Stephen, making him the first Christian martyr. It was a mob action where he was speaking, and they hadn't originally planned to kill him. It wasn't an official execution by appointed authorities. They just did it because they were a mob. And here's a riot. Acts chapter 19 speaks of a group of silversmiths whose business is being hurt by the Christian missionaries. People aren't buying their little idols anymore. And so Demetrius, the head of the silversmiths, gives a speech and says, "Men, we're losing money. And besides, it's not fair that our great goddess Artemis isn't getting as much worship as she used to, and we all want that, of course." So he's got his money motive as well as, you know, yeah, of course we want religion too. And so this group of guys starts yelling, and they're mad, but they're mad, and they know why they're mad. They're not getting a good income because the Christians have been making converts to Jesus who no longer buy their idols. And so these guys, these manufacturers of the little idols, start yelling, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" Soon the whole city was in an uproar. The assembly was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some another. Most of the people did not even know why they were there. And that's a good picture of a riot. As a sociologist define it, most of the people really don't even know why they're there. They're just having a hullabaloo and they're ticked off about something, but they're not even quite sure what it is. But behind many riots, there are ringleaders who start it, and they know exactly what they wanted. And so, again, it's helpful to understand when you're looking at the sociological evaluation of riots. Yeah, there may be a widespread rioting by people, many of whom are kind of clueless what it's all about. They're just, well, everybody else seems to be doing it, and we're mad too. But behind it, there may also be a well-orchestrated group. That happened with Jesus, where there was a near riot when he was standing before Pilate, and they were yelling, "Crucify him, crucify him." The mob's yelling, and they're threatening to start a riot. But behind that, there's a small group of leaders who had calculated and planned out the whole thing and got all that yelling and screaming started. So there's uncontrolled rioting, and there are very shrewd people who sometimes know how to start one. Collective behavior can also refer to behavior that's diffused or dispersed over large distances. We often think of crowds as gathering in the same place, but not all collective behavior has to occur in the immediate vicinity of others, compact crowds. In diffuse crowds, this is true with the advent of mass media, which allows for the rapid spread of information around the world. You don't have to be in the same place to be part of the same crowd. You can all be venting on social media and getting madder and madder, and you may be living thousands of miles apart from each other. That's a diffuse crowd. There are several different theories of crowd behavior. Contagion theory, convergence theory, emergent norm theory, gathering theory. So let's see what our textbook says about each of those. Contagion theory was originally proposed by Gustave Le Bon. And contagion theory proposes that crowds exert a hypnotic influence on their members. People kind of get hypnotized, and this hypnotic influence combined with the anonymity of not everybody else knowing who you are, you're just part of the crowd, results in irrational, emotionally charged behavior. Or, as the name implies, the frenzy of the crowd is kind of contagious, like a disease, and the contagion feeds upon itself, growing with time. This also implies that the behavior of a crowd is an emergent property of the people coming together and not really a property of the people themselves. They just kind of catch it like a disease. There's problems with this theory that some sociologists highlight. The theory sees members of crowds as irrational, but much crowd behavior results from rational fear. It's not irrational to want to get out of a burning theater and the whole crowd wants to do it at the same time. It's not irrational to be outraged at some terrible injustice and the crowd all gets angry at the same time and get, you know, it's not just an irrational thing. Some are irrational, but some it may be very rational outrage or very rational fear or very rational joy for that matter. Crowd behavior is often instigated by and guided by individuals. It's not just a disease that people catch. We've seen examples of that already. There are sometimes ringleaders who have a very rational and calculated purpose in trying to set that crowd off. So just explaining it as some sort of hypnosis or some sort of disease that's spread, not quite that simple. And crowds are capable of any emotion, not just negative ones of anger and fear, but of joy and ecstasy and getting all excited together. And contagion just kind of treats all of that as a disease. The convergence theory says that the behavior of a crowd is not really an emergent property of the crowd that just happens while they're there, but it's more a result of like-minded individuals coming together. If a crowd becomes violent, a mob or a riot, this isn't because the crowd encouraged violence just by being there as a crowd, but because the people who got together wanted to become violent, and they came together as a crowd. So it's not the being in the crowd that made them violent, it's the being violent that got them together in the crowd intent on doing violence. So convergence theory says that it's not so much the crowd dynamics as such, but the drawing together of like-minded people. There's a tendency for people to do things in a crowd that they would not do on their own, however. And so there's criticism of convergence theory that says, yeah, but not every crowd or every collective behavior of a crowd is the result of people coming together because they were intent on doing that. Sometimes they got together and things got out of hand or things got very different than they planned on. Or, to take a different example, a revival meeting, maybe people got together for an ordinary church service and something happened there and something started happening and it started influencing each other. And so there is a tendency for people to do things in a crowd that they wouldn't necessarily have done as individuals. And crowd anonymity sometimes leads people to outlandish behavior. They are never, some of the riots or weird things that you see after a team wins a championship and they're overflowing, they're overturning cars or doing crazy stuff. Some of it's because they're under the influence of alcohol, but some of it may be because they're just part of a crowd. And if they're all by themselves, they wouldn't think of doing such crimes. Some crowds may result from like-minded individuals coming together to act collectively, but some crowds spur individuals into behavior that they wouldn't otherwise have engaged in. Then there's emergent norm theory of crowds. This combines contagion and convergence theories and argues that it's a combination of like-minded individuals, anonymity, and shared emotion that lead to crowd behavior. So you got those three things. They are like-minded. They got together in the first place because they shared some interests or they were intent on doing something. But there's also the anonymity factor and the whipped-up emotion factor that leads to crowd behavior that goes beyond just what like-minded individuals might have planned to do. People come together with specific expectations and norms, but in the crowd, new expectations and norms can emerge, leading to different behavior. And then there's gathering theory. Most gatherings are temporary. Subgroups of individuals who already know one another tend to stay together throughout the gathering. So within the crowd, there's other little crowds. And Another part of crowd theory is that crowds of their own don't automatically impair judgment, although if they've been drinking or taking drugs, then of course judgment is impaired by those factors and not just by the crowd. And gatherings can disperse by an emergency. The police come and disband them. It can be dispersed by planning. Somebody said, hey, it's time for it to end. Or they can just go away because people lose interest. They lost enthusiasm. So gathering theory observes that gatherings vary a great deal. They're not all the same, and there's a lot of different things involved. A panic is sudden terror which dominates thinking and often affects groups. Panics typically occur in disaster situations and may endanger the health of the affected group. Architects and city planners try to be ready for the symptoms of panic, such as herd behavior, often using simulations to decide the best way to lead people to a safe exit. So you want enough exit in a building, several exits. You want pathways to those exits so that people can get to them without all trampling on each other, have wide enough aisles. And that's why sometimes there's building codes, too, that say you can only have so many people in a building at a given time. You could fit more, but you're not supposed to have that many because in case of a panic, they wouldn't be able to exit safely in a hurry. A riot is a form of civil disorder in which disorganized groups lash out in a sudden and intense rash of violence, vandalism, or other crime. While individuals may attempt to lead or control a riot, we've seen some examples of people who were pretty calculating in starting one, riots are typically chaotic and exhibit herd-like behavior. So you may start a riot, but you can't always end one, and you don't always know what it's going to lead to. Riots often occur in reaction to a perceived grievance, or they happen out of dissent. So sometimes you get a riot in protest. Maybe they got together to protest a certain action by the government, and it turns into a riot. Or maybe there was a legal decision that was made, and the people disagree with that decision, and so there's a riot. And then there's mass hysteria. Hysteria is a diagnostic label applied to a state of mind, one of unmanageable fear or emotional excesses. People who are labeled hysterical often lose self-control. The term also occurs in the phrase mass hysteria to describe mass public near-panic reactions. Mass hysterias can also occur in the sudden onset of psychogenic illnesses. You hear something's going around and suddenly you're getting sick too. And there is this phenomena where people actually start feeling or claiming the symptoms of something they hear going around when actually there's not a biological cause for it. A fad, also known as a craze, refers to a fashion that becomes popular in a culture or subculture relatively quickly, remains popular often for a rather brief period, and then loses popularity dramatically. Real Christianity, just it's worth commenting, is more concerned with eternal reality than with trendy fads. Sometimes it's a temptation for churches to market themselves to the latest fad or for sermons to always be up on the very latest fad. And it's okay to be contemporary sometimes, but beware of being too trendy or too faddish because these things come and go. And you may think you've got the hot thing going, but if the hot thing isn't the Lord Jesus Christ and you hitched the gospel to that supposedly hot trend, it won't stay hot for too long. Rumors. Unverified account or explanation of events circulating from person to person and pertaining to an object or an event or an issue. Three characteristics of rumors. They're transmitted by word of mouth. Second, they provide information. It may not be correct information, or it may be, but they provide information about a person or a happening or a condition. Oh, I heard this about so-and-so. Or I heard he wasn't really a citizen, and yet he's running for president. Or a condition. We heard that he's going to be injured for the next game, and so we really can't count on them winning. And so you hear about stuff even when it's not verified. And the third thing about a rumor is it expresses and it gratifies the emotional needs of the community. One of the reasons it spreads is they're very curious about it. And one of the reasons they sometimes believe it is because they want to believe it. For example, you hear a bad rumor about somebody. We sometimes like to see people brought down, even when we say we don't. And so we believe that rumor. Or you hear another rumor about something that you really do want to have happen, and you hear it's going to happen, and you tend to believe it just because you wanted to. So rumors are transmitted by word of mouth. They're providing information, supposedly, about something or somebody, and they often are something that scratches an itch that the community has and kind of wants to hear anyway. Here's some types of rumors. Pipe dream rumors reflect public desires and wished for outcomes. And so the rumor spreads rapidly because people wanted it to be true, even if it's not. Then there are bogey or fear rumors, and they spread because there's a widespread fear or panic, and it's already out there anyway, and people are ripe for fear, and then they hear the rumor and they believe it, even when it's not true. And then there are wedge-driving rumors intended to undermine group loyalty or interpersonal relationships. You start a whisper campaign against somebody because you don't like them, or you want to undermine them, or you want to take them down, and you want to separate them from others. You want to drive a wedge between them and others, and you use the rumor to do that. Rumor bombs. Negative rumors are more likely to be spread than positive rumors. Yeah, I guess that's true. And rumors may also be political communication strategies. Be very aware of that. A rumor bomb uses the link between politics and various forms of media, from cell phones and internet to radio, TV, and print. And political operatives spread rumors to weaken opponents. And so a rumor bomb, you say, it's been said that he's had an affair with somebody. Or it's said that he cheated on his taxes. Even if the information isn't verifiable, if you can just get a rumor going, it can do quite a bit of damage. And you can spread various kinds of rumors now more than ever when you're a political operative because of media networking and social networking. If you can get something started on a social network, you can do a lot of political damage. And sometimes foreign powers even try to weaken another nation by spreading rumors within that nation, using social networks, posing as citizens of that nation. And sometimes it's even been spread rumors and the starting of demonstrations, and it's been found out that both the demonstration in favor of the political leader and the demonstration against that political leader were started by the same people, members of another country, who just wanted general division and strife in the country. So they just try to turn both sides against each other. And so rumor bombs can be used against people of another political party or even people of another country. The Bible speaks about rumor bombs. It says they sharpen, only it speaks of them as arrows rather than bombs. They sharpen their tongues like swords and aim their words like deadly arrows. They shoot from ambush at the innocent man. They shoot at him suddenly without fear. And here it's not talking about assassination with arrows. It's talking about their tongues, about the rumor bombs they spread. But God will shoot them with arrows. Suddenly they will be struck down. He will turn their own tongues against them and bring them to ruin. So rumors aren't just a neutral thing that, hey, you happen to be in politics, this is one more tool that you use. It is something that God detests. And using a rumor bomb against somebody outside of politics that you just want to harm, God notices, and He opposes it, and He will hold you accountable. Sometimes even Christians fall for rumors, and they spread rumors. It's good to know some of the online resources for checking out widespread political rumors or urban legends. Snopes.com helps you to check out certain email rumors that get emailed out to lots of people. Urban Legend helps, and Fact Check helps you check out political rumors. I know that I'll take one example. I would receive concerned letters from people and emails and so on when I was in gospel broadcasting on the radio saying, oh, what are we going to do? Madeline Murray O'Hare, the famous atheist, is leading a campaign to make all Christian broadcasting illegal in the United States. And Madeline Murray O'Hare had been dead for over 10 years at the time, and there was no such campaign. But the Christians heard it, they were kind of paranoid, and they believed it, and they were going to lead a campaign to stop it when it wasn't even happening. So they got involved in collective behavior based on rumor. And I've seen that many times since on Facebook and other social networks where people, Christians even, will be saying something about what the non-Christians are up to when it turns out not even to be true. So we want to be very cautious about spreading untruths, and here's one way, or three ways actually, to check out some of the rumors. Here's the truth about rumors. A gossip separates close friends. The words of a gossip are like choice morsels. They go down to a man's innermost parts. We said one part of a rumor is people have appetite for them. And another part of a rumor is that they're often used very negatively. Some churches and Christian groups have more damage done by rumors than by some of the more frowned upon sins. Gossiping is as wicked as many of the other things that Christians may frown upon. If anyone considers himself religious and yet does not keep a tight rein on his tongue, he deceives himself and his religion is what? Worthless. Whoa, that is a harsh statement. Your religion is worthless if you're just a rumor spreader and you don't keep a rein on your tongue and if you don't watch how you speak of other people. So that's the Bible's truth about rumors. The Bible calls us to avoid bad collective behavior. Don't spread false reports, that's rumors and all of that, and don't follow the crowd in doing wrong. Hey, Exodus was way ahead of the sociologists. 3,500 years before we talk about rumors and crowds from a sociological perspective, God says, don't spread false reports. And if a crowd is up to something bad, don't follow that crowd. Romans 12 says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So be aware that collective behavior can sometimes get you involved in things that are not right at all. Get your head on straight. Get your mind transformed. Be able to recognize when you're part of a healthy crowd and a healthy movement and when you're not. And don't just conform to it just because everybody else is doing it. Here's healthy group behavior, as described in Romans chapter 12. Each of us has one body with many members, and these members do not have the same function. So in Christ, we who are many form one body, and each member belongs to all the others. So people can have their individual distinctions and differences and talents and personalities, and yet they're also connected. And so it is healthy to have group behavior. We shouldn't say all group behavior is bad. No. The church is a group, and it's meant to be a healthy group, which doesn't stifle the individuality of the people within it, but instead harnesses all of that individuality together in a beautiful way where everybody serves one another. Rejoice with those who rejoice. That's collective behavior. If somebody's sad, then the rest of us can be sad with them. If somebody's happy, the rest of us can be happy with them. Live in harmony with one another. That's godly, healthy group behavior.